All right. So welcome everybody. This is Q&A call number 6 for Smart Body Smart Mind 18.0. Thank you for being here and for sending in your questions as always. So this week, quite a few common themes. This is where two or more people write in asking essentially about the same kind of thing. And there's actually four of these this week. Where there is a lot of shared inquiries. So the first one I want to talk about is the strange experiences of nervous system-based trauma healing. So when we're working with the nervous system, when we're working with our body, and we're working to release, make space for, interact with these old survival energies, we can experience a lot of really strange feeling stuff. And for a lot of people, this can be very difficult to accept as just how it is, because we have had, at least in our culture, a lot of conditioning around anything that feels out of the ordinary, like you better go get that checked out, right? So I've got a tingling in my arm. I've got this electrical like kind of feeling in my leg. I'm having these strange pulses. My heart is pounding. I've got sweats that don't make any sense. Like all things that might send someone to the doctor. And then very often the answer is, well, there's nothing going on that we can find. And all of these experiences are really normal when doing this work. So the nervous system is an electrical system, right? So think about all the different types of sensations electricity could produce as it's moving through your tissues. Now, think about what if that electricity has been dammed up, and the tissues have been frozen for decades sometimes. So when that stuff starts to thaw out, we will almost invariably start to feel all sorts of things that we have not felt before. A lot of times we've been living in functional freeze or non-functional freeze, and we're just numb in general, and feeling anything feels kind of weird. I remember a couple experiences working with clients, doing touch work with the abdomen, and they started to get motility and some gurgling as their digestion kicked in. And they never felt that before. They thought something was wrong. Like, oh my God, what is that? It's like, no, that's your digestion. That's what's supposed to happen. But that's not unusual if we've been really locked down in a lot of freeze. So people asked about, I've been having, one was like, I've had heat for the last 10 months coming up. Is this normal? Yep, totally. Heat is sympathetic energy, fight flight energy moving through the system. Think about what happens when you get really mad. You get red in the face, you get hot, right? That's just when that stuff's been stored up, starts coming out, we will just feel heat randomly, totally normal. And then they said in the last month, they started to have this experience of feeling chills that last for a few seconds and they come through. This is awesome. This is the freeze starting to lift. So when freeze starts to lift from the system, it actually feels cold. It can feel like very cold moving up the spine. You can feel like you can't really get warm. You can have that sort of oh, just feeling. Your feet can be cold. You feel the freeze as it starts to lift. And it often is an experience of like chilling. I have this one experience I remember where after 3 4 hours I just was my so cold as this big freeze was moving through, and I just got all cozy and wrapped up in my blanket and put my feet in some hot water, and later on took a bath and just made space for it. It's great. So when we're not afraid of these things, they are really powerful indicators that we are actually making progress in healing. Now, what can happen is we can get scared of these things that then put us into more survival. The system packs up what it's just been trying to release, and we sort of stuff it down again because we get scared of it. And that's what we want to try to avoid. We really want to try to welcome these experiences. Now, it can be hard. Like, for example, someone else wrote in, so I've been waking up at night with my heart pounding and feeling all this heat. Yeah, totally normal. Totally normal. Heart pounding again. Why would that happen? Sympathetic nervous system fight flight response. Your heart's going to pound so that you can run and fight. And that can be weird when it happens when you're just laying down trying to sleep. But as we're falling asleep, very often, as we're doing this work, the body sort of takes the hint, and the defenses can come down as we're starting to drift off and go to sleep. Our internal ways in which we may have packed stuff up, maybe those are shifting, and we start to go into sleep and get a little bit more vulnerable. And then, okay, wow, here's this energy that's been waiting to come out. So yeah, that can be inconvenient. Someone else asked about spasms that feel like electrical shocks in random places. Yep, totally normal. I've experienced that a lot. Muscles just start going blah, 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 and vibrating, and that can happen for a day or a few days. Or once I had a piece of work done with my eye, and my muscle around my eye just twitched for about a month on and off. All of this is normal. It is all totally normal. It's part of the weird, fabulous experience of somatic trauma healing. As the body starts to wake up and these old charges start to disperse through the tissues. Another person asked about a sense of vertigo arising after eating a few bites of food. And this is an alumni who's been doing this work for a long time. And this was a new experience. And generally speaking, like, yeah, when something like this happens, it's a new experience. It's like, yes, all right. Yeah, that's uncomfortable. But that's a sign that we've reached a different layer. There's a new level of something happening here. One thing I wanted to say about that is I wonder what her experience was like eating at the childhood dining room table growing up. Was there a lot of stress? Was there a lot of tension in the atmosphere? I wonder if there's perhaps something associated with that. Because they say, I have a sense of vertigo after just eating a few bites of food. Now, another possibility is there could be something happening with the vagus nerve here. So the dorsal vagus nerve is connected to our digestion. It governs that system as well as everything underneath the diaphragm, all those organs it innervates. Perhaps the vagus nerve is waking up a bit and something is happening as your body starts to digest. Now, the ventral vagal nerve is associated with the face, and there it's not directly connected to like the vestibular system, but there could be some kind of shift going on where the system's like not sure how to handle this new information of the vagus working in a different way. And maybe the vestibular system is responding. It doesn't always make sense, these things. And so they ask this one, you know, my inner voice says, just build capacity and wait. Is there anything else I should do? And that's essentially it. Just see what happens. But yeah, I'd be interested to examine like, well, what was it like for you when you were eating food growing up? Was it a very tense? Was it scary? Was there unspoken things? Was there tension? And maybe feel into that a little bit. So all this to say, all of these experiences are normal. If you want to rule things out, that is sometimes something that people will want to do, and absolutely go for it. Like if you want to go to the doctor and do a bunch of tests and see if there's anything wrong that they can pick up, that can be helpful. Because then you know, like, nope, there's nothing they can find. And that is very often the case. That's usually what happens in the context of this work. Or they get a mystery diagnosis, or like, oh, you just have fibromyalgia, or you have whatever it may be. You have OCD, or you have ADD, or you have, you know, whatever it is. They may try to fit a label on it, and that may not be helpful, because it's possible that this is just your system doing its thing, processing this old energy that's been locked up for so long. So if you feel like you want to rule stuff out, go for it. Just know that you may get, you know, they may find nothing. I know some people who have sort of gone on a merry-go-round of specialists, you know, like they go from this person to this person trying to figure out these symptoms. And all it is their body waking up and releasing old energy. So that's my first recommendation. Whenever you experience any of this stuff, try your best to welcome it. Now, it's different if you're feeling like acute pain that feels really like strong, that's different. Like that's a signal. And it's still, I mean, to be clear, can just be trauma processing. When fascia comes out of bracing, when tissues that have been stuck for a long time start to move, it can really hurt. And there can be nothing wrong. It can be exactly what needs to happen. But you don't want to necessarily, you know, mess around if you're feeling that in your chest, for example, or if you're feeling a sharp pain in your abdomen. It's, again, it may just be fascia, it may just be organs shifting, or it could be something serious. So maybe in those cases you want to get checked out. But just please know, all these weird, weird, weird things are normal. So the next section was about safety, safety in the home. And what is a safe home environment? What is an unsafe home environment? And what is safe enough? Like, what do we mean when we say you need it to be safe enough? The reason this is so important, which we've talked about a lot in the past, is that if you're working to come out of survival mode, you don't want to be in a home environment that keeps putting you into survival mode, right? So you really can't progress in this work if you're living with people who are abusive, who are really toxic, if your home environment is constantly putting you into stress for one reason or another. It can be really difficult to progress because we need some kind of safety. Now, ideally, let's talk about first what a safe environment is, like a truly safe environment. That would mean that you either live on your own or you live with people that you really feel safe with, you can be yourself with, you can express yourself, you can roll around, you can make weird sounds, you can cry, you can get mad, you're allowed to have all your emotions without fear of any kind of, like, even someone saying, oh my gosh, what's going on, are you okay? Like, no, like, there needs to be a shared understanding that, like, I'm processing my stuff, they know you're processing your stuff, it's all good, everyone's on the same page, everyone's supportive, great. That would be ideal. Or yeah, you're on your own, you have pets maybe, but it's like, yeah, you have no one in your environment that is causing you stress or who is violent or toxic, acting in toxic ways. That's ideal. An unsafe environment is when those things are happening. You have someone who's abusive, who is just constantly stressed and in their own misery and constantly wanting to talk to you about it, who's always in drama. If you live in a situation with super, super noisy neighbors, this is constantly putting you into stress, that can count as, like, just, even though it's not literally unsafe, it can feel unsafe because of the noise. If there's, obviously if you're living in a war zone, anything like that, that is clearly unsafe. Not a good time to be doing the work in those cases. Well, safe enough, what does that mean? So that may be something like, okay, yeah, I'm living in this situation and my roommate, I really, like, yeah, I mean, they're okay, but they're always in drama. They're always wanting to vent. They're in some toxic behaviors, or maybe they're in an addiction pattern or something. And in that case, it's like, how do I make a safe enough environment if I can't move right away? Now, ideally, what I would say is move. Like, get yourself into a solo living situation or with a better roommate. But of course, that can take time or may not be immediately possible. So then it's about boundaries and having practical boundaries and communication. So you may need to tell this person, look, I'm working through some stuff. I really need you to not, like, vent all your stress at me. Like, I understand, you know, but it's like, I'm really trying to work on myself. And I just don't have the energy to hold space for that, you know. And then you may need to have your room really be like your safe, sacred space. You may want to have a lock on your door, so you know, like, that's a practical boundary, right? Nobody can come in because it's padlocked from the inside, or you have a deadbolt, or whatever it is. That can really be useful. If you're in a situation like one who wrote in, where it was just really noisy. And that's constantly triggering them. Well, again, move if you can, but until that's possible, earplugs. Maybe you just get some good earplugs that are really comfy. The silicone earplugs that they make for swimmers, those are quite comfortable. And I use those for traveling if I'm in noisy situations. So maybe you just walk around with some earplugs and you make your environment safe, quieter that way, or you do a little soundproofing if possible. Of course, you can try communicating to the person who's making the noise. That usually doesn't go very well, because very often there's a reason they feel like they need to make all this noise and they're not considerate in the first place because of their own stuff, right? So being proactive to just quiet the sound, wear some earplugs, listen to music, have some sound-canceling headphones, anything that can make it quieter for you and a little easier for your system. Another option is spending time outside of the house in situations that are safer, quieter. Maybe there's a community center. Maybe there's a gym where there's a room that you can like roll around in and do some movement and do a little of this sort of neurosensory practice. Maybe it's at the park. Maybe you have a nice park you can go to. So exploring other options as well. Ultimately, though, we want our home environment to be safe if we really want to move forward with this work. One final note, if you're living in a situation that's truly unsafe, it's not the best time to do the work because you won't really be able to move forward. So in those cases, I suggest more practical approaches that are about personal empowerment. So this could be seeking support services. There are services out there that can help you if you're in an abusive situation and you want to get out. Definitely take advantage of those. Law enforcement, restraining orders, sometimes that is important. If you really need to have a hard boundary with somebody that's making your environment unsafe, and other things that you do for personal empowerment. So like learning a martial art, if that's something you could do, maybe more useful than getting into nervous system work if you're living in an environment that's actively unsafe. How can you instead maybe just focus for a while on personal empowerment, making yourself stronger, making yourself feel a little bit more capable and knowing that you might be able to defend yourself. That can add a lot to your sense of personal safety and agency. Okay. Now, this next category, there is a couple questions about this. How do we come out of being like parents for our parents? So many of us grew up with parents who used us as their emotional dumping ground or who just were constantly in their own stress. And we as children instinctively learned that, oh, in order for me to be safe, I have to make sure they're okay. And so we learn to take care of our parents in a way that is really not helpful for us as developing human beings. We need to be the ones being cared for and having our needs met and seen to. Very often in dysfunctional homes, especially single parent homes, this can happen. There's a dynamic of codependency and emotional caretaking that the child develops. And it's not like a decision even. It's like they learn at a very young age, oh, I better modify myself in some way so that mom is okay, so that I'm okay. And that is something that's quite unfortunate as we go into adulthood, because we can end up in this dysfunctional pattern of still trying to take care of them. So how does somatic work help with that? How do we have better boundaries between myself and other people's emotions? So first, we need to be at least cognitively clear that it's not our job. Like, we need to at least get that at a mental level first. A lot of people will struggle just with that step. Like, what? It's not my job to take care of my parents and see to their every need. It's not my job to listen to all their emotions and not really have room for my own. Absolutely, it's not. It's not your job. It was their job to take care of you and to be there for you and your emotions and your experience. So getting that at a cognitive level is the first step. Really encourage you to take that in. Even if you don't necessarily believe it, start repeating it to yourself. This is not my job. Now, of course, ideally, we would be in a society where our parents are taken care of in a practical way as they get older. This is truer in some other cultures where people do really look after their parents into their old age. That becomes really problematic when our parents were the source of our trauma. And I really, even though it sounds kind of cold, sorry, you got to figure it out. Like when you are someone who it's like because of your parents, you've spent 40, 30, 20, 50 years, like just trying to get out of the shit that they put you in. That is not a situation in which you should be taking care of them. And like, sorry, there's nothing, I got to take care of myself because you didn't do your job. So there can be a bit of a harshness to that, especially when there's been an enmeshment at a really deep level. It can feel a person can feel a lot of guilt, a lot of shame yanking at them. But it's just like, man, you got to take care of yourself. You really can't help anybody. I mean, right? Until you yourself are well. So that's got to be the priority. So in terms of somatic work with this, what does it feel like when you go into caretaker mode? That's the first thing you got to start to pay attention to. Like, don't even worry about necessarily trying to stop the behavior. What does it feel like when you start going into the mode of taking care of your parents, of managing their emotions, of making space for all of that? What do you notice in your body? That's the first thing to cue into. Chances are there may be something in the chest. There may be like a pulling feeling in the heart area. There may be constriction in the gut. The heart and the gut often will not agree about these things. The heart on its own, without the wisdom of the gut, is kind of a fool, really. Like, the heart will just give and give and give and give, or take and take and take and take. And the gut is what tends to tell us at a deeper level, no, this isn't good for me. So like, you may have an experience of feeling sort of expansive, or even like, oh, I'm doing the right thing, or like touched, like having a feeling of being sort of, oh, that's a touching feeling, or but then your gut may be like, ah, no, right? So just tune into what's going on for you as you're in this dynamic. And then that is a signal to you in the future that, like, ah, I'm doing that thing. I need to stop doing that thing. Right? That's our bodies tell us when we're doing something that isn't really good for us. But it can take time to suss that out if it's a really old pattern, which this is, if it's continued into adulthood. Ultimately, we really want to have boundaries and the sense of potency and agency within ourself, which is also a somatic quality. So we develop this with things like the potent posture lesson, cultivating the exhale, the vu and the vu ah lesson, the healthy aggression work, the annihilation work. All of that is about getting in touch with our sympathetic energy in a way that is potent, life-giving, affirming, that validates our agency, our sense of ability to act. So really feeling into those tools. And that may be like, say you get a call from, there's a call on your voicemail from your mom, and she's doing the same old thing, and she's trying to get you involved in all of her suffering. And then like, okay, now you've been paying attention. You notice, oh, here's my heart doing that thing where it feels like it's reaching out. And as that happens, my gut constricts. Okay, there's my cue. All right, what do I do instead? I'm going to put my feet on the ground. I'm going to stand up. Yeah, I'm going to sense my sense of potent posture. I'm going to breathe into my belly. Maybe I'll let out some voo, and feel my jaw open. And maybe I'll squeeze my fists and press a bit with my feet. Maybe I'll stomp a bit and breathe, right? You're changing the somatic pattern. The pattern is to just go with this thing that is so embedded. Oh, I notice that. I stop. I do something else. I do something that supports my agency and my potency. Now, all of this may often need to come along with actual boundaries of saying to your parents or whoever it is that you're enmeshed with in this way, sorry, I'm not available for this kind of conversation right now or anymore. And that, again, may be confusing, hurtful. They may try to guilt you back into it. They may whine, complain, tell you that they're going to die. Oh my gosh, if you don't do this for me, I'll kill myself. I mean, the amount of ways in which a person will try to manipulate to keep you in a toxic bond like this are innumerable. And it's like, nope, sorry. Yeah, go ahead. I'm going to take care of myself. It can be difficult. I had experience like this with my own mother. That was really, really hard. Where, yeah, it was the same pattern. I had learned to take care of her. She was a psychologist. She used to like to vent to me about all her clients and all of her feelings about all her clients. It was a very, again, this is not unusual. It can feel to the parent like, that we're close, right? We got this emotional bond. You're my confidant, right? That's really toxic and unhealthy. It's not how it's supposed to be. And there got to be a point, where I had to, at a practical level, say, hey, I'm not available to support you anymore. I'm working on myself. I have a son. My son is my priority when it comes to support. I'm sorry, I can't help you. And, she pleaded and begged. This is really, really painful. And I had to hold my ground and say, no, no. Thankfully, my sister was able to help her out and take her in. Otherwise, she probably would have ended up on the street. And that is something I had to make peace with, because it was either that or I lose all my money, I lose all my ability to care for my son and care for myself. And so that was a clear decision point that I had to make. Thankfully, it worked out okay, but it can be really difficult, when we get faced with these types of decisions. Again, I wish it wasn't the case. I wish we were in a society and a culture where parents, knew how to do their job and were empowered to do so and weren't living with generations of unresolved survival stress themselves. But that's not the reality we're in right now. So we do, I believe, as people who are working on themselves and dedicated to their own healing, sometimes need to make some tough choices when it comes to how we're willing to be there for other people if we don't really have the ability to do that. Okay, last common theme. What about if I'm not really feeling much while doing these exercises, while doing these neurosensory practices? Long histories of living in freeze, living with lots of dissociation. Both of these questions were talking about how I really struggle to feel very much. One of them said, I'm always bored. I have no motivation to do anything. I feel lonely and I don't have any friends, but I don't want to socialize. I don't have anything to say. I feel emotionless and blank, but that I sense that there's anger and grief underneath, but I can't connect to it. Another person who had said, I spent most of my life dissociated from my body. When I'm doing the neurosensory exercises, I find myself having a hard time feeling my body. I'm often lost in my thoughts. What do I do to stay on target? I'm not feeling anything in the exercise except being relaxing. What should I try? So first, I mean, this is the frustrating answer to this question, which is, yeah, you just gotta practice and practice and practice and practice and practice and practice. This is why it's a lifestyle. It's not just something you do for 12 weeks. It's something that you dedicate yourself to and develop a new way of being with yourself. And it takes a lot of practice. You just got to keep on doing it. So it's like you're laying down new tracks, right? But like the train is used to going down these tracks that have been there forever. And you're making new tracks over here. But it's like the train just keeps on going down that track. It's like, well, every time I notice that, I need to drag it over here and think about this different way of being. At the core, what that is with this work is instead of paying attention to your thoughts and following your thoughts, shift your attention to your body and what's happening there. Sounds simple, it's really fucking hard. It takes so much practice. And you just got to keep doing it. Eventually, it gets easier. And so maybe at first you do it successfully for a few seconds and then you're back in your thoughts. Okay. Then you do it again later. Then you try again. Then you try again. Then you try again and again and again. It's just a matter of the work. This is why it's called work, right? It's not just easy. You have to keep making that effort to notice your body. Now, the next step is you use your tools. Once you tune your attention to your body, okay, how can I discover what's happening there? So, for example, on the surface, I feel emotionless and blank, but underneath, I feel like there's anger and grief I can't connect to. Well, but you are connecting to it because you feel like there's anger and grief. So if you really couldn't connect to it, you wouldn't have that sense. There's something telling you there is anger and grief here. What is that? Can you find it? Maybe it's just, I can't name it, but it's just a sense. Awesome. Start there. Where is the sense? Is it in your torso or is it in your legs? Maybe like you get really broad. Is it in your head? Kind of. Okay, great. Is there anything? Can you feel your feet on the ground as you notice that? Basic steps of inquiring with ourselves and our systems about what's going on. What am I noticing? The more you pay attention to your body and make that effort, the more it will reward you with information. It does respond, but it's like it can take some time. It's kind of like if you say if you know a buddy that you've ignored for 20 years and all of a sudden you're getting interested in them, like what the heck, where have you been, I got nothing to say to you. You left me, Oh, well, but I'm back. Really? I don't trust that you're back. Well, I'm back, and I'm just going to keep on showing up and telling you I'm back until you believe me. And eventually, some trust starts to build, and the body starts to open up, and it starts to give you more and more information. So it's about doing the work over and over and over. Now, another element of this may be that you need some human connection in order for your system to open up. It may not be enough at first to just be on your own with audio exercises. So it may be that it'll be helpful to get a little bit of one-on-one connection with a good practitioner just to start to build the basic tools of being able to orient, being able to talk about your sensations. It can be helpful to have a skilled practitioner who can like point out stuff that you may not feel in, like, hey, what's going on in your shoulder there that's like raised up like this, right? There can be all sorts of ways in which it can be helpful to get that real-time feedback from someone who's really skilled and trained in this work. And we have a lovely team of practitioners. We have a team on the site who are available for sessions, consultations. That's right there on the SPSM site. So check that out if you feel like you want to explore some one-on-one work a little bit, just to see if that's helpful in getting into the body. Because sometimes it is. Sometimes it's not enough just on our own. Other times it's actually way better on our own because we have a really hard time trusting anybody else at all, no matter how skilled they are. So it varies, but it's something to consider as an option. But mostly it's about the work. Now, another final piece on this is bring in touch. Bring in your own touch. If you feel like you can't feel anything, squeeze your arms. You're gonna feel that, right? Put some hands on your chest and on your belly. Feel that place of contact. Breathe. Can you feel your hand on your chest? Can you breathe and notice that there's movement? Or your hand on your belly. Can you breathe and notice that something happens? There's a little bit of movement. Just spend some time doing that. Or maybe you sort of do a containment thing. You hold your arms and you really feel that coziness. You get a blanket maybe. You feel that sense of a tight, sort of contained feeling. Just hang out with that. Just bring in external things that convey a sense of touch and feel that as a way to practice and keep building this ability to notice things. We'll often ask people early on, can you feel your feet on the ground? Because lots of times people aren't paying attention to the fact that their feet are on the ground. But if you direct them to it, yeah, actually, I can notice that. I do feel a sense of that. Or can you feel that there's something under your butt? Can you just notice that you're sitting and there's something meeting you there? Because can you feel the chair at your back, right? All these simple ways that we can bring in the ability to notice ourselves. And then we do it over and over and over again. Okay, so that's it for common themes. 35 minutes. So I'll do a few of these individual questions and we'll have a little pause. So, first one, you have said that we often encounter similar trauma over and over. I have chronic fatigue, which has lessened a lot during the years of SPSM, But my life still feels very small, and every time I get up on my feet, I'm knocked back down for months. Following an opening in my health and capacity, something happens, or I try out a new health thing that massively backfires. I want to get out of this pattern, but I don't know how, since I also try out lots of things that do help me. How do I work with this? So some of this, it sounds like, is just kind of productive trial and error. Like, you're trying out some things, some of them work, some of them don't. That's kind of how it goes, you know. So in that sense, there's really nothing wrong here. However, I do sense that there is a dynamic at play here, which is really, really common and that you may be able to avoid. So when you say, following an opening in my health and capacity, something happens, or I try out a new health thing. So this can be really, really normal, especially if you've been living with chronic fatigue. You start to feel a little bit better. You start to feel a little bit more energy. Oh, you start to feel like I can do something. And then you do way too much because you get excited. And this is, of course, understandable, normal, but it produces this type of experience. What we want to do as we start to feel a little better, feel a little more capacity, is change nothing. Don't do anything new. Just keep doing what you're doing. Don't try a new health thing. Don't go out and do more shopping than you normally would. Don't change anything. Just keep doing what you're doing. Kathy Kane talks about it like, oh, you've got more energy. And like, I want to spend it all the way. No. Don't put that in checking. Put it in savings. That energy needs to go into your savings account because it's going to enable the deep process of repair to continue to happen. And also, doing this will break any cycles that may be there about overextending yourself. Very often, the way that we get into a situation of having chronic fatigue in the first place is by living in an overextended way for years and years and years, where we're just always doing too much, always doing too much, always pushing ourselves, living on survival energy, and then we crash. So the system really needs modeling of consistency. Starting to feel a little better? Great. I'm not doing anything different. I'm just going to notice I'm feeling a little better. That's it. And usually it's that simple. Now, the other thing you want to look out for is if there is a repeating pattern, because yes, this can happen where we do experience the same trauma over and over again. Just what is the nature of that? What's the theme? Is there some common theme that's always related to, it sounds like the theme may be, I'm feeling better, I'm going to try a new thing, and now I'm on my butt again. So that's just an important thing to notice, and just as a cue to help you not do that thing. Like, just pay attention to, maybe there's thought patterns that are really familiar that come up as you're starting to go into this. Like, you start thinking about all the stuff you could do, or I want to try this, or maybe I should try that thing I've been wanting to check out, and just don't do it. Don't do it. Keep doing just what you're doing for longer and let that energy slowly build and accumulate. Okay. Hello. I recently felt hate come up towards my partner and I felt righteous in it. I feel terrible because I ended up acting out from that state and feel bad afterwards, and it brings back memories of other times I felt this. I felt hatred come up with my sister when I was young and felt helpless. I told my mom I hate her when I was a child. It feels like rage. What could help me in those moments when I feel the unhealthy impulse to lash out? So it sounds like you may not have gotten into the healthy aggression and annihilation work part of lab 6 yet, because that is exactly what this is all about. It's what this is for. When we have old fight flight energy stored up for a long time, and we've been through experiences of being wronged, abused, hurt, manipulated, gaslit, suppressed, repressed, whatever it may be, that combination of old survival energy and never being able to protect ourselves in the past, it's gonna lead very often to this experience of feeling hatred. So it's a normal response. It's not unusual what you're experiencing. Definitely, we don't want to act out from that place in terms of just letting it rip. And yeah, it can feel very righteous. That's an important component, which I'll get back to. That's really important. But we don't want to go with that and just let her ride and do all the things that it's telling us we should do, because that is not going to be good for us or anybody else around us. But we don't want to suppress it either, because that is what happened in the first place. So that's where the healthy aggression work and the annihilation work comes in. Really powerful, important work. So just go check out that lab. Check out healthy aggression in lab six. Check out that lesson. And then there's links in there as well to the annihilation article. But I will talk about it a bit. So the healthy aggression work is about letting the mammalian system act, essentially. What does a mammal do when it's fighting for its life? We have all those parts. We have the teeth, the jaws, the eyes, we have the claws, right? We have the fists, we have the arms and legs. We have all the stuff. But most of us aren't really familiar with using these things. Because, of course, we're not supposed to. We're not supposed to go bite people and claw at them and scratch them and hit them, kick them and all that stuff. Yeah, that's not a good idea. But those systems want to act. Like they want to do that stuff, but we're not supposed to. What do we do? Okay, yeah, we do that stuff by ourselves, or with the support of other person who knows how to support us with that. So that, may just mean, like, where's my, just one second. Grab this thing. You can use a towel, that's fine. These are really great. These are called TheraBands. And these are really helpful for this. But you can also use a rolled up towel. Right? Oh, yeah, I see someone's got something there. The green thing, great. So, like, basically, what you want is something you can put your force into, right? So you can really twist this, and it really lets the arms and the shoulders work and the squeeze, and then let it go. Really, really powerful when you're feeling angry to just simple, right? But there's a lot of repression in people's systems that may not let them do that growl, that may not let them do this with their mouth and their eyes. Right? You can do it. It's okay. So the first thing is to give yourself permission to start mobilizing these things. It's all right. You're not going to hurt anybody. But you can get the satisfaction of using the things that want to hurt somebody. That's the idea. So, kicking, punching, those types of things generally don't work quite as well because they're very fast and explosive. And when we're talking about old stuff, right? Kicking, punching, hitting, that's great in an actual survival situation where like you literally need to like fight for your life. With this old stuff, we kind of want to be able to stay connected to the felt sense of the body, to memories and images and emotions that may arise that are part of it. So that's why we don't want to do stuff that's maybe a little less explosive and fast. That's why we don't say like grab a baseball bat and beat the heck out of your bed or something like that. That's a little too much. So, but twist, squeeze, growl, stomp, maybe, push with the legs. All that is great. Really, really helpful. You'll be amazed what happens if you just let yourself do that when you're feeling pissed off. So the annihilation work is a further evolution of that. It's more advanced. I encourage people, everyone, get comfy with the healthy aggression stuff first, so that it's natural. You can snarl, you can growl, your eyes can narrow, you can squeeze, you can do all this stuff, you can make sounds. You're comfortable mobilizing that stuff. Get that online first, please. Then you may want to explore the annihilation work, which is specifically about working with the energy of hatred, which is essentially sadism. It's about allowing yourself to have the experience of being cruel and sadistic in a safe way. Because again, sometimes we need to do that. There can be this imprint that we take in that's like that internal critical voice that I'm sure so many of you are familiar with. Like it's this internal little monster that wears the face of our father or our mother or our high school teacher or the classroom bully or whoever it was. Like we feel like they're inside us, right? Their voice. But it's not them. Like they can't be. They're a human being over that way, right? They're way over there, or they're dead, they're passed on. We don't even know them anymore. Who knows? But we still have this voice, this representation of them inside. This is an introjection, is what we call it. It's where we've basically used our own energy to create this little golem inside of us that's representing a person from the past who destroyed us or hurt us, abused us. What we need to do is destroy that. That's what the annihilation work is. So we see ourselves destroying our father, for example. We're not actually hurting them. They're not there, right? This is something inside of us. And what we're doing is we're liberating our own energy from being stuck in that little golem. Like, that's our energy. What's it doing wearing our dad's face? That's not helpful. We need to destroy those things sometimes. And that's what the annihilation work is. And it's about seeing and moving and feeling all at once, right? So it's a fantasy that you really want to vividly see. You want to see the blood. You want to see the guts. You want to rip out the entrails. You want to feel it on your fingers. You want to get the gory details. Because again, if that hatred, that sadism is in there, that's kind of what it wants ultimately. It wants to destroy. Ultimately, what we're looking for is a feeling of triumph. So where you said, I felt righteous in it, we want that in our imagination, in the imaginary process. We want to end up where it's like you're standing on the corpse of your enemy and you're like, aha! Like I have won. I have conquered all the foes. And you feel this like empowered, righteous glee. Of like murderous glee, essentially. That's kind of what you're looking for when you're doing the annihilation work. And again, all of that takes a lot of foundation building, right? Like emotional bandwidth, the ability to stay connected to our sensations as we're imagining things, as we're doing the movements that want to happen all at once. So that's the medicine for what you're describing. Go check it out. Take your time with it. Build those healthy aggression tools first, and then start to explore maybe the annihilation work. So, all right, let's take a little pause, and go have a little water, get away from the screen if you want, bathroom break, etc. And we'll come back in 3 or 4 minutes. Alrighty. So I just wanted to pop a couple links in the chat here. And again, of course, these will be on the replay page. I see that one of our lovely support teams, Susan, already put in the link for Team Lion practitioners who are available for sessions. Also, here's a couple links. This is the SE International Directory. And then this is a link for people who are trained in Kathy Kane's touch work. And because someone had asked, do you mean I should look for an SE practitioner? I was talking about sessions. Yeah, absolutely. And everyone on our team is qualified and good. Or if you want to look elsewhere, there's a couple options. I do usually encourage people, if they are looking for a practitioner, if possible, try to find someone who has both SE training and Kathy Kane's training. The reason for this is the SE training is not in itself, unfortunately, a guarantee that it's going to be a good practitioner. There are all kinds of people who go through the SE training who have actually no idea how to do this work, which we hear horror stories about, unfortunately, from our students. So if someone has done SE training and they've also worked with Kathy, chances are better that they'll be good. That's still not a guarantee. And you may find someone who's just done SE and they're great. So it's hard to say. What I'll say when it comes to finding a good practitioner, bottom line, you have to feel safe with them. I mean, you may not feel fully safe, especially at first, but you have to feel like they get you. Like you have to feel a sense of like, okay, like this person understands. They should be able to give you, after a first session, a pretty clear picture of what they feel that you need to work on, and maybe an idea of like, this is kind of what we're going to be focusing on. And that should make sense to you. If there is no, there shouldn't be like, you'll be better in 3 weeks. Like if someone gives you a definite time period, run away, because that's impossible to know and they can't know. But there should be ability to give you like a general sense of like, oh yeah, it seems like you're struggling with these things, and we can work on this, and I think, we'll work on supporting these areas. How's that sound? A sort of collegial kind of, we're on the same page. We're working together. How's that feel? And you should have a sense that like they kind of get you. They kind of understand where you're coming from. Okay. Someone else asked, what about when I go into healthy aggression and immediately tears come up? So that might just be part of the release of the experience, as Carrie said. That's not uncommon. There is another thing that can happen, though, where as soon as we start to go towards aggression or start it, we have tears because we've been programmed that way. Like, so we may have been told, oh, your tears are okay, but your anger is not. Now, unfortunately, women get this way more than men. Men, it's the opposite. Your anger's okay, your tears are not okay. So, and I can't believe that that still exists. And yet it does. And especially for people in my generation and older, that programming could be really strong. So what can happen is we start to move towards aggression and the system gets scared. It says, no, 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 that's verboten. Tears are acceptable. Remember, tears are okay. And so the tears will come. If that's the case, in that case, what you want to do is little steps, little touches into aggression, and then come away so that your system starts to learn it's all right. So that might just mean, oh, I'm just gonna squeeze my fists and then I let it go. Like basically, as soon as you start to feel a little hint of emotion that's like in the tears camp, you back away from the aggression. Come back to it later. Build the capacity to do it. Or that may not be the case. It may just be part of the aggression because aggression and grief are often layered together like an onion. So you may do a good piece of healthy aggression work, and then the tears come, and it's not because anger is repressed, it's because the grief is what's next. And it's just part of this overall process. So it can be different ways. What you want to look out for is if like it's impossible to get angry without crying, then you know that there's a coupling going on here where your system just aggression feels like too dangerous. Okay. Right. Good. Next one. Hello, I had an abusive brother growing up. My therapist recently suggested I label it as such. We were estranged as adults by my choice, and then he died from alcohol abuse related complications. The mix of anger and complicated grief about him and the lack of safety I experience in the world and my body because of him feels stuck. I don't know how to process these emotions through my body because I still feel allegiance to the story. I feel stuck. Any insights would be appreciated. So just as I talked about here, we have rage, anger, and grief, but they're in, instead of being in layers, it sounds like they're all bound up together. And yeah, when that's the case, when we have sort of contrary emotions all sort of stuck together, it can be really hard to move forward because we have to sort of disentangle these things in order to process them first. It's too much to like process it all at once. And there may not be enough clarity to process it if these emotions are all intermixed. Now, one of the most important things I hear here is I still feel allegiance to the story. Well, clearly that's not a helpful story. You will, I'm sure, on the other side of processing all this, be left with probably a more helpful story. The probably best approach for now is to just really ditch the story entirely. Give yourself permission to leave it. And you don't have to even invent a new story. Just the story is in your mind, right? The story is something that's happening in your thoughts, maybe your emotions. We need to get into the body. So emotions are of the body. Emotions are physical. We could also have thoughts about our emotions that we think are emotions, but they're not. They're the thoughts about the emotions. This is where most people actually live, is thinking about their emotions instead of really feeling them. Emotions are physical. They are sensations. So if you find yourself in the story, okay, I'm noticing I'm in the story. What am I feeling? Again, dragging the train onto the new tracks. What am I actually feeling as I'm thinking about the story? What's happening in my body? That's number one, because we can't disentangle the grief and the rage without getting into the body and discovering where these things live. So it may start out as it just feels like just a mess. Like it just feels like a knot in there. Like there's just a tangled knot. Okay, let's investigate that tangled knot. Can we get curious about it? Can we really feel where it is? And then one of the most helpful approaches with this kind of thing is rather than going into that knot, into that place of feeling stuckness, instead you work on making space around it somatically. So, okay, I'm out of the story. I'm feeling my body. There's just this tangled mess, like, it just feels stuck. It's in my chest. I'm making all this up. I don't know if this is what will actually happen, but just as an example. Okay, I feel a sense of a tangled, stuck kind of knot in my chest. Okay, great. Maybe that's where you leave it for the day and you just go along, because that's a huge piece. You've just shifted from the story into something in the present that's actually happening in your body that's related to this. Great. The next time you come back to it, okay, here's that thing, all right? I'm not going to move my attention right into the middle of that and like try to like all of a sudden process it. What if I just think about it having a container? Okay, I'm feeling this like, say, in my solar plexus. Okay, can I just feel where it's not that anymore? This thing is happening here, but oh, okay, I can notice in my thighs that's not happening. And I can notice that like up here in my shoulders, I don't feel that. So there's some territory where it's not that. You feel the area where it's not that, and then you feel the area where it is that. And you just kind of go back and forth. You're making a container. You're making space around the problematic area that feels stuck and tough to deal with. Maybe you refine that later. It's like, okay, no, now as I get more practice with this, I can really feel this is like in my solar plexus. It extends down about to my little, just above my belly button, and it comes up just to like the midpoint of my sternum. And okay, it's kind of like I can make like a sphere that holds this. Great. Okay. Starting to get to know it more, starting to get more detailed. And then, okay, what if now that I have a sense of a container, what if now I start to bring a little breath? I bring in the principles of the diaphragm lessons. I'm going to expand this area of my body, and I'm really going to see, like, okay, here's this thing, but here's the space around it. And okay, the space around it is breathing. Okay, cool. What happens next? Usually, that's the point very often when something starts to happen. So we may start to feel a sharper pang of emotion, or some tears may come spontaneously, or we get really hot. We start to get more specific sensations as we are able to hold a container for the experience in a somatic way. Final idea is write out the story. You have the story, okay, you feel allegiance to it, okay, you need to chuck it for now. And you need to get into the body, write out the story first. And you, since you have a therapist, maybe have your therapist read you the story. What do you notice in your body as someone else reads you the story? That could be another way of getting into the physical system, because then you're not having to track your own story and your body at the same time. You're listening to the story and you're paying attention to your body. That could be another way to investigate it. Okay. Hello, I'm a 2021 alumni with early developmental trauma, medical, and shock traumas. After starting SBSM, I developed more sensory sensitivities. I was probably in freeze, and this increased sensitivity is the expression of underlying sympathetic energy. Do you have experience that this will eventually decrease? For me, it's not. I'm wondering if I'm an undiagnosed neurodivergent. Explaining my just living life seems intense from the moment I was born. Do you have experience or knowledge with neurodivergent clients and possible evolution? All right. So, a couple things going on here. First, yes. What you describe when you say here, I was probably in freeze, this increased sensitivity is the expression of underlying sympathetic. Yeah. And also, it may not be just sympathetic, it may just be sensitivity. So, when we've been living in freeze for a long time, again, like I said earlier, we may just be numb. We may not feel much. We're sort of going through the motions. And then we start to do this work. And then, oh, wow, we start to feel all sorts of stuff, which just sounds like what's happening here. Now, of course, that can include, yeah, sympathetic energy. We start to feel heat. We start to feel vibrations. We start to feel a sense of electricity, energy, anger, whatever it may be. You're just feeling more. You just feel more of everything as you start to come out of freeze. So that's important to recognize. It's actually a really good sign. Yes, if it's sympathetic energy that you're feeling, that can decrease, but you have to work proactively with the sympathetic energy. Sometimes it may go away on its own, but usually at first we gotta participate. So that's the expression, following your impulse. What are the sounds of that energy? What are the movements that want to happen? How does it want to act? What needs to happen with your body and that sympathetic energy that never got to happen for you, right? That's where we want to start to work with the energy to discover what it needs to do. That's how it decreases, is by going with it and letting it do the things that it wants to do. Where that's where we get into the healthy aggression work, et cetera, et cetera. So that part of it, absolutely, it can decrease. We just have to help it along the way sometimes. Now, there's another thing though, which is when we've been living in freeze and we start to thaw out, we do just become a lot more sensitive. And that doesn't mean we're neurodivergent. And the whole neurodivergent discussion is kind of problematic in the context of somatic trauma healing nervous system work. Because here's the thing. The whole world is basically living in freeze. That's what's normalized. So normal equals frozen and kind of numb. All right? The whole world, industrialized world, is pretty toxic. There's all sorts of very real toxicities in our environment that an awake, sensitive, healthy human can't tolerate. So are you neurodivergent, or are you just a healthy, unfrozen human in a toxic world where freeze is normalized? It's the second thing from our perspective. The world isn't freeze, the world is toxic. As you become unfrozen and sensitive, you start to perceive the toxicity and your system doesn't like it. And that's normal. Okay? Feeling like the world is overwhelmed since you were born? Yeah, because it is. Because the world's running survival mode. Because everyone is like running around. Go, 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 go. The systems of power, the structures of this world right now, they're not healthy. They're not normal. So I don't think you're neurodivergent. I think you're contacting your innate humanity and sensitivity in a world that is frozen and toxic. So just a way to think about it. Now, there are true neurodivergent conditions where there are brain injuries, where there are genetic issues, where there are things that happen in utero. Our colleague Mara works with a lot of kids in this camp. And so it is a real thing. But lately, the term has been taken and pasted onto everything that's a little bit different. And it's like, yeah, it's a little bit unrefined and maybe not that helpful. So I would encourage you to more consider that maybe you're just becoming a normal, sensitive human in a world that's tough to be in as a sensitive human. That's about it for that one. This can be tough for people to hear. A lot of people get a diagnosis of, oh, I'm neurodivergent, oh, I'm autistic, oh, I have ADHD, I have ADD. And that feels really helpful because it explains their experiences. But I'm saying there's another explanation, which you might want to consider, right? Normal humans who are fully sensitive, awake, and healthy are going to have a tough time in a lot of the systems of this world because there's a problem with the systems, not with the people. Right? Not that being neurodivergent is a problem, if that's the way that you identify. I'm just saying, as we learn more about trauma and how it affects people, it gets more complex. All right. I rely on government support while healing, but the reviews feel like interrogations. The assessor even often misquotes laws and regulations, which heightens the threat. I feel unsafe before, during, and after every assessment, no matter how I try to self-regulate. Can we work with our nervous system to find even small moments of safety when power is unequal and support can be taken away? How do we rebuild trust in our bodies and the world when systems that are meant to help us re-traumatize us? And here's exactly what I was just talking about. Yep. Yeah. So yeah, it's a shitty system to be in. It's also helpful, you know, like, yeah, you can get some government assistance. I'm glad, like, I believe in social safety nets. I think that's really important. And I think we actually, they could be like way, way better. The way that they are right now. Yeah. You got to like show up and basically defend your right to get it, be assisted. Which feels threatening and overwhelming. And yeah, often the people aren't that nice and they're on a power trip because they're in a position to lord that over you and because they've got their trauma, etc., right? So yeah, I definitely hear you. It's not fun. There are definitely some things you can do at a nervous system, somatic level, for sure. Essentially, this is about boundaries, agency, and potency, and capacity. So one thing, just at a practical level, if you have an assessor who's misquoting laws and regulations, like personally for me, like I would address that. That's not okay. I would speak to a supervisor. I don't know if that is like, if that's dangerous, then okay, maybe not. But like, I would imagine there's a way to speak to a supervisor or someone anonymously and say like, hey, this is going on. Cause that's not okay. Like they're not allowed to, you know, make up the rules. Now, in terms of what you can do before, during, and after, there's no doubt it's a tough situation. Can you reframe it a bit as if it's a game that you're playing? You got to play the game to get the thing. So maybe you're becoming the character that wins the game. And it's something you're choosing to step into for the period of this interview. Okay, for this interview, I'm going to be the person who gets the assistance that I need, How do I need to be? Okay, I need to be like this. And you're aware that it's a game that you're choosing to play. And hey, all right, trick's on them now. Ha ha! You just worked the system. You played the game and you got what you needed. They didn't even know you were playing a game, right? There's ways that you can reframe it in your own mind that may be useful so that it gets out of this power dynamic that you're feeling. Ultimately, they don't have any power over you. I mean, they're just a person doing their job, right? What sucks is they do have some power because you need the money, right? So you want to put yourself in a situation where you get the money. Do that by, okay, I'm going to choose to be how I need to be to get the thing. It's important that be deliberate, because otherwise it could very easily be going into like a fawning response that is like something that you don't, you know, that is, could be an automatic behavior. Like, this is how I act anyways. I get into a situation with someone who I perceive they have power over me, and I make myself into the person I feel I need to be so that they won't hurt me. And that's not helpful to reinforce necessarily. So that's why it's like, okay, it's about the mindset. It's something I'm choosing to do because it's a game. And I'm going to come out of it, you know, maybe you have a special pair of shoes you put on when you're in this role, and then you take off those shoes at the end. Like, there's all sorts of ways you could maybe be creative with it to support that mindset shift. Now, somatically, what I would really support you to do is focus before, during, and after on your potency, your agency. So potent posture, right? When you're in the office, instead of sitting like this, you know, okay, I'm going to sit on my pelvis. I'm going to feel my sit bones. I'm not going to slouch. I'm not going to be rigid, but I'm just going to, yeah, I'm going to feel my feet on the ground. I'm going to feel my butt on my chair. I'm going to sit upright. I'm going to maintain eye contact. All right, I'm just going to feel that. That can be really hard. Potentially, if it's really unfamiliar, that's why I recommend practicing before, right? So here I am, I'm going to put on my going into the assessment office shoes, and I'm going to sit there in these shoes, because I know these shoes, and there they are on the ground, and I'm going to just feel this. I'm going to visualize that assessor in front of me, and I'm going to feel my butt, and I'm going to feel my feet, I'm going to feel my spine, I'm just going to look around. Practice. And do what you can of that during the interview. It's not about being, you know, puffed up. It's just, I'm present. I'm here. Do that afterwards, right? Maybe there's some healthy aggression that needs to come out afterwards. Maybe you need to wring the assessor's neck afterwards. Don't do it for real, please. You know, that's what imagination is for. That's what the healthy aggression tools are for. And that may very well may be useful to discharge the energy in a way that, again, supports your potency, supports your agency, etc. It also may be useful to bring in resources. Maybe there's just, you have something that you hold that you like the feel of, and you keep that in your hand. Maybe you have a supportive friend with you beforehand and after, so that your social engagement system's feeling a little safer, right? All sorts of ways that you can support yourself. So play around with that stuff. Now, in a big picture sense, you ask, how do we rebuild trust in our bodies and the world when systems that are meant to help re-traumatize us? And that's the systemic toxicity that I was talking about, survival mode. I have an article I'm gonna refer you to that is all about ways to do that, which is called Cultivating Internal Safety in Today's World. Because there are so many practices you can do just as a daily thing that can be very, very helpful for supporting our sense of internal safety. Most of it revolves around connecting to the earth instead of the world. Those are very different things. Can't remember the quote, something like the world is a man, but the earth is a woman, something like that, Chesterton. But the energy of the earth is a very different thing than the energy of the world, the systems, right? The culture, the society. So a lot of connecting to nature in various ways is really, really important. There's also various practices you can do. It's all, everything I can think of is in that article that I linked there. So give that a read. But yeah, also just accept that you're right. The world systems, even the ones that are meant to help us, can be really stressful and toxic. And that sucks. And it's not you. It's the system. Hello, alumni here. I use CYBAM to go deeper into emotional states, and I use renegotiation to resolve old trauma. Sometimes I wonder if I should stick more to just being with the sensations of the body, as is taught in SBSM. Could you elaborate somewhat on the concepts of CYBAM and renegotiation, and especially about when it's better to stick with the somatic sensations and what the body needs to do, and when it's better to use CYBAM and renegotiation as part of working with what's coming up? Okay, so first, what does renegotiation mean? Renegotiation means I'm experiencing the same set of stimuli that was traumatizing, but I'm having a different, better outcome. I've renegotiated the experience. So when I got, you know, for me, okay, when I used to be trying to do my homework and my dad is standing right there screaming at me as a way to help, okay, that was a traumatic experience that I've renegotiated. And what did that look like? Well, what did I want to do that didn't get to happen then? Okay, well, first, the familiar stimuli is I've noticed I have a tension pattern. I kind of want to go like this in my body, and that's like there all the time because I'm trying to escape the screaming voice. Okay, there's the familiar stimuli along with the memory and the somatic imprint. What's the renegotiation? I'm going to stand up and I'm going to attack him. Like, and that was a particular piece of somatic work I did. It was very slow, but it was from going from this to extending this way and standing and allowing aggression to come out. And that was the renegotiation. I had a different experience. I actually did the thing my body was wanting to do that I couldn't do. So that is different than just tracking sensation, right? CYBAM is a model that we've talked about before: sensation, image, behavior, affect, meaning. It's an acronym Peter developed that conveys kind of the sum total of how we experience the world. So when we want to use CYBAM is when we're stuck, essentially. If we're stuck or we're looping, then we want to be able to... I just got distracted by something. We want to be able to tap into other elements of our experience. If we're just tracking our sensation and nothing's happening, okay, I'm just feeling the thing, but I'm just feeling the thing. Nothing's changing. What now? That might be when we want to bring in elements of CYBAM. So the S is sensation. What's the image of the sensation? Oh, okay, it's like a crackly green lightning. Okay, great. See the image, feel the sensation. Can you see a different image? What would be an image of an area of your body that feels different? Okay. I'm going to move my attention to somewhere else. I'm going to see an image of that. Or what is that sensation? Is there a sense of what it wants to do? Is the way, like behavior, the B, what's the behavior that wants to happen, etc. Meaning is usually the last thing that just sort of arrives after we engage all the other senses. So when you want to use other elements of CYBAM is when you're stuck, when nothing's happening, when you're just feeling sensation but nothing's changing. If you're just sitting and tracking your internal sensations and they're changing and evolving and things are arising and things are falling away and you're feeling some emotion come and then that shifts and some temperature change, like great, you don't need to do anything else. You're just, your system's processing. Often that kind of processing happens more and more and more as we get more into the work. Earlier on, we tend to need to do things more because, again, like the system has been stuck or repressed or judged against, and it needs a little support. It needs like a help, a little kick in the butt, like, hey, I'm not just going to sit here and track. I'm going to act. I'm going to do something. I'm going to express myself in some way. That usually is more needed earlier, sometimes a little less needed later. At least that's been my experience and experience that I've witnessed in a lot of other people. As you get more and more familiar and your system gets more and more open, things can just kind of happen. And it's kind of a quieter process and stuff just moves through. That's when you use CYBAM, is when you need to a little help. You need a little help to get stuff moving. Now, the thing I got distracted by, I just my fault having the chat open, but someone had said we put the link for Smart Body, Smart Mind practitioners available for consultation. If that doesn't open for you, you just need to log into the site. Links that go to the site won't open unless you're logged in. So that's the case for any link we post in SBSM. If you're not already logged in, the link won't work. It'll just take you to the sales page. So yeah, you have to log in for that to work. Okay, closing the chat. Can you please describe what a regulated mind looks like? I've noticed that I've more regulation and thinking and thought patterns have automatically become healthier, but thoughts mostly are still happening to me and stress-filled versus feeling like I'm at the driver's seat of my own mind. Absolutely normal. This is what I've experienced myself, what I see and hear from others. The mind, the thought patterns are usually the last thing to change. You can be pretty darn regulated, but still have like the same kind of unwanted thoughts and loops that go on. And I'm not sure why that is. It's just maybe the nervous system is maybe a little bit more adaptable than those actual thought patterns. I'm not sure. Now, the first thing to do essentially with thought patterns is again come out of the thoughts and into the body. Like that is the biggest way to diffuse rather than trying to change the thought pattern. Just leave it, get out of the thoughts, get into what you're sensing, feeling physically. There are people who find hypnosis can be quite useful for changing thought patterns. If you know a good one, who's the real deal? That can really be helpful for changing some thought patterns if the system is regulated. If the system is still dysregulated and we try to go hypnosis, generally speaking, does nothing because the underlying architecture that's driving those thoughts is still at play. So, hypnosis, cognitive behavioral therapy, thought retraining, that stuff generally doesn't work or only seems to work temporarily if we are still living with dysregulation. But if we've become more regulated and it's just the thought patterns that are echoes of the dysregulation, which has been my experience, sometimes hypnosis, cognitive behavioral therapy, and thought retraining can work. So can you please describe what a regulated mind looks like? What that looks like is we have the ability to choose not to think and to simply be and witness our experience. Which is the difference between thoughts and consciousness, etc. Essentially, like I'm just sitting here, not thinking anything, just feeling my experience. I'm seeing my environment. Then you can choose to think about stuff. Like, oh, I'm gonna think about this. That's a regulated mind. Hi, Seth. I've been an SBSM for 2 years with CPTSD and a similar backstory to you. I'm finding it hard to do a single practice due to ADHD and non-functional freeze. Can you please share in detail what you specifically did to heal your trauma and dysregulation? And from a neuroplasticity perspective, how often someone would need to do the practices generally and daily for true healing to occur? What would an average day or week need to look like practice-wise to achieve true healing and regulation? So my healing story, SBSM in 21 days wasn't around. Because Irene hadn't made them yet. So we just went the old traditional route of seeing a practitioner, and I saw a practitioner pretty regularly for about 7 years. That started out monthly or bi-month or maybe once every couple months. Eventually, as I got more and more into it was more like every 2 weeks. There was a period where I was really moving through it when I was seeing him every week for a while. That was maybe 6 months or so. But more often, it was more like every couple weeks, once a month. But what I was doing with him is the same stuff that we're teaching you to do with yourself. Okay, so there's nothing different. Tracking sensations, working with my diaphragms, working with my joints, feeling my layers, learning about containment, using my resources, using healthy aggression, using annihilation work. That is, by the way, not even from SE. The annihilation work is only because I got to work with my mentor, and that comes from a different teacher named Yvonne Agazarian, who developed the annihilation work. That's how I did it. And then everything that I learned, that Irene learned by working with practitioners is what's in SBSM. except for we're teaching you how to do it for yourself. Now, how often would someone need to do the practices generally and daily? What would an average day or week need to look like practice-wise? What it means is you are always doing all of it, basically. Like, I don't mean you're always listening to the audio lessons. You've done the audio lessons enough that you don't need to listen to the audio lessons. You know how to work with your diaphragms, and you do it when you feel something stuck and chunky in your chest or in your pelvis, etc. You know how to work with your joints. You know how to orient. We ideally are always orienting 24/7. When we're asleep, there's still a part of our mind that is aware of what's happening around us such that we wake up if we need to. When we're awake, we are always seeing where we are and feeling what's present in our body. That's an ideal, right? So that means we're always practicing it. We're always practicing it, always. The idea with these practices is that they become part of a way of being that should have been innate in the first place. But because of the society we live in, that stuff got not taught to us. We didn't learn how to feel our emotions necessarily. We didn't learn how to investigate our sensations, make space for them, work with our body, all this stuff. So it's something that you have to build. And what it looks like is you're always doing it. This is why we keep saying over and over, this is a lifestyle. This is a way of being that we're teaching you how to do. And then the idea is like, yeah, this is what you do. This is your life. My life is about feeling what's present in me and allowing it to be expressed and to move through and to be in the environment. And like, thankfully now I can do that while just living a normal life, helping other people, etc. There's a long time where I couldn't do that as much. My job was working in kitchens because I didn't, you know, it was much less demand on my system and I had more free time to just work on healing. So my lifestyle changed. But yeah, the work just is just always, it's an always kind of thing. And that doesn't mean you have to have that right away. It takes a long time. It takes a long time to learn a different way of living that is much more human. And it's not supported by our world, right? So it's like you're the rebels, you know, you are going against the grain of what is expected in society and good for you because you're learning how to be human beings again. All right. Last question. Processing emotions, you say, as I recall, there should be a physical component. A bit into this work, I notice I'm more irritated, angry. I used to be perceived as angry when young, even if I didn't feel angry. As an adult, I have been angry, but often not acting adequately due to the fear, shame, and anxiety. Now I worry that as I notice and feel, I don't get physical impulses. Am I just entertaining it or conserving it? Okay. And there's a second part to the question, but let's just do this. So emotions, yes, they are physical. So you, just because you're feeling your emotions and you're not getting an impulse to do something, that's okay. You're still feeling your emotions as long as you're actually feeling them and not having thoughts about them, like I talked about earlier. Emotions are clusters of sensations that we've given meaning to. Sadness it's a wave. Grief ultimately is like sort of this wave that moves through the body and it's really intense. And the tears come out of the eyes. However, most of us experience sadness or grief as constriction in the throat and the chest, because that's the body trying to contain it, actually, not let it out. When grief really comes, it's expansive and like a wave. But we got to get out of the way and learn to let those structures of the body open up, cue diaphragm lessons, etc. Emotions are physical. Anger is heat and the body tensing, ready to act, right? Grief, disgust. Shame, all of these are physical sensations that we feel. So you doesn't necessarily need to be a physical impulse to do something in order for the experience to be physical. So I hope that makes sense. And the more you spend time just being with the physical component, the physical sensations of emotion, the more your body will perk up, and then you maybe you like start to get some impulses. It's really about just holding space at first a lot of the time. And it's really about discovering your own organic impulses, which feeds into your next question. When you say, you know, as an adult, I've been angry, not acting adequately due to fear, shame, anxiety. Well, that didn't start as an adult. Those seeds were planted as a kid. Right? And it's most likely you were told that it wasn't okay to be angry. You say, I was perceived to be angry when I was young, even though I didn't feel angry. So maybe you weren't angry. Maybe you were just being assertive and don't be angry, right? Oh, you're angry, right? Or maybe you were angry about your situation and that showed on your face. Right? That's another physical component of emotion, is like someone walks around like this as their resting face, they're going to be perceived as kind of angry. Like, what's up with him? Like, what are you talking about? Like, we have no idea. Like, this is happening. This is just how I live, right? So that maybe you had a irritated, grumpy look on your face as a kid because your body was showing what you were feeling, but you weren't supported in feeling anger. Instead, you were supported in feeling shame, anxiety, right, about your experience. So it sounds like if you're feeling angry, great, make room for that and notice how it is physical. And notice your impulses in general so that you can just keep building that relationship with your body, with your system. Part two, I have work I struggle to get done, finishing reports. I do the job, enjoy it, but then I struggle, procrastinate with reports. Today I tried investigating it a bit more, unsure if it was a feeling or a thought, but the notion that it is some kind of protest, it's like, it's boring, I don't want to do it. It goes with a story that I wasn't listened to as a child. Ah, okay, no wonder you were perceived as angry. You probably were, you weren't being listened to, right? My parents didn't have that skill, so I didn't learn to listen to myself. I was never good at playing since I felt I had to be the one taking responsibility from a young age. Now I want to do fun stuff, which I'm being told is good for me, but I don't know what that should be since it all turns into shoulds, gardening, handcrafting, etc. It's confusing, but somehow it feels all linked. It absolutely is all linked. Yeah, this is about you needing to discover your own impulses, which are in the wisdom of your biology, which you cultivate by taking time to listen and make space for your experience, which is what didn't get to happen when you were a kid, right? So just keep doing that, keep doing that. And I do want to point out that, yeah, when you say here, the protest, this is classic resistance. So go back and watch the pregame video on resistance. That's could be a good thing to, if you haven't watched it already, or to rewatch. So working with resistance, but yeah, it's about finding the energy in the resistance. And in these statements here, it's boring, I don't want to. I hear like a kid, I don't want to, that's boring, right? There is an anger in that, right? There is energy there. So work with the energy in the resistance itself. And again, that video is useful for checking that out. And there's also an ebook as well, but I think it's all in that video in the site. So, okay, there we go. Thanks so much all for hanging out for the past 90 minutes or so. And yeah, really look forward to seeing you again on the next call. And just keep doing the work, keep doing the work, keep doing the work. You know, the more we can embrace that, like, yeah, this is just a different way of living and it's going to take time. And what else am I going to do? You know, it's like, well, yeah, do it. Thanks, all. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.